slides. When we come to the 13th century, we have a bit more information as far as our sources are concerned. So let's again begin with the Bible. We have, of course, the tail end of the period of Ehud. He had this long 80-year period of peace. So that really comes down into the end of the 13th century, down to about 1237. But then picking up from there, we have Judges 13:31, which just one verse on Shamgar. We can't do too much with that. But then following that, we have Judges 4 and 5, dealing with Deborah and Barak and their battle against Jabin, king of Hazor. And here we can, in fact, connect this with some historical information. This would be roughly 1237 to 1198, the period of the oppression and the overthrow of Jabin, king of Hazor. We have Egyptian records, specifically from the reign of Seti I, concerning a campaign into Canaan. And then also under Ramses II, we have references to a campaign in his 8th year. Also, he had a campaign in his 18th year. And then there's references, undated references to campaigns, and we can't tell if they go with year 8 or 18 or some other year. But basically, Ramses II campaigned in Canaan during the first half of his reign. Now, he ruled many years, what is it, 66 years or something, a long, long time. And so, toward the end of his reign, he's older and not as energetic, and so from the records available to us, it appears he did not campaign at all in the second half of his reign. We also have the famous Merneptah Stela. Which I will talk about more when we get to the slides. But he had a campaign very early in his reign, within the first couple of years. We can date it to approximately 1210 BC. The campaign of Seti I is about 1291. And in fact, that is what marks the division between Late Bronze 2A and Late Bronze 2B. Usually we just say 1300. There were a few destructions at that time, and we know that there was a campaign by Seti I, so this is used as a kind of a marker to divide off the archaeological periods at that time. Yes? Of Merneptah. Merneptah is the pharaoh. Yes. Then we have some. We have also a very interesting document called Papyrus Anastasi. T-A-S. Anastasi 1, which would date to late 13th century. And this is a satirical letter from a royal official named Hori, written to a scribe stationed in Canaan named Amon M. Opet. This scribe evidently is with the army. His job is to record all that's going on there. But he's kind of a greenhorn, and this official Hori is chiding him on his lack of knowledge of the land and geography, the people, and so on. And it reflects conditions in Canaan at the end of the late 13th century. And it's very fascinating to read. It talks about robbers are on the highway, and this road is real bad, and there's a steep mountain here, and it names places and geographical features. We have quite a few inscriptions from Palestine. At Beth Shan, we have two stelae. We have one of Seti I, which, in fact, we have two of Seti I from his 1291 campaign, telling about what he had accomplished in that campaign. And there's a reference there to Apiru. He fought against the Apiru. And then we also have a stela of Ramses II of his year 18 campaign. Then we have some other inscribed material from the reign of Ramses II, which indicates that he constructed buildings at various places in Canaan, because we have his cartouche carved into stone, found at a place south of Gaza, then stone blocks from a gate at Jaffa, just south of modern Tel Aviv, and then a foundation deposit tablet from Afek, with his name on it. So he was quite active building structures in Canaan during his reign. Perhaps the most important to find is a letter from a person named Takalinu. Takalinu, who was an official at Ugarit. And this letter was found at the site of Afek in a large Egyptian residency type structure there. And it was written to an Egyptian official named Chaya. Both of these men, Takalinu and Chaya, are known from other correspondence and other records. So we can date this letter very accurately to the latter half of the reign of Ramses II. This site of Afek was destroyed, was attacked militarily and destroyed by fire. So we can date that event and all of the pottery and so on found in the building to the end, toward the end of the 13th century, sometime around 1220, maybe 1210 BC. Then we have in Syria the material from Ras Shamra, which is ancient Ugarit. Now, this is not historical. It's not talking about military campaigns and the like, but it's very important because it gives us a lot of information about the Canaanites. A lot of religious texts were found there, a lot of myths and so on. And so it's important for knowing something of the Canaanites. Also, many of the texts are written in an alphabetic pre-Canaanite script, and it's the material is important for studying Hebrew, Canaanite and Hebrew language. There's a lot of poetical material important for studying the poetry of the Old Testament. So we don't have time really to get into that material, but it is very, very important. The Ugaritic material from Ras Shamra. Let me rush on and say a little something about Deborah and Barak and their battle against Jabin, king of Hazor. Hazor, as you recall, was excavated by Yigal Yadin. And he indeed found a destruction at the end of the 13th century, which he dated to 1230 BC. Yadin connected this destruction with the Israelite conquest and Albright's 13th century conquest theory, put a date on it of 1230 so that his destruction would correlate exactly with Albright's dating of destructions at other places. That dating, you know, has a plus or minus factor on it, but I think we can say with a great deal of confidence that it took place toward the end of the 13th century, certainly in the second half of the 13th century. After this destruction, the city lay abandoned for about a century. Hazor, in fact, appears to be the first of the Canaanite city-states to fall. They all fell in the period at the end of the 13th century and the early part of the 12th century, or the period at the end of the Late Bronze Age and the beginning of the Iron Age. And one by one, they fell, they were abandoned or destroyed, and Hazor seems to be the first one in this process. It was destroyed violently by fire, and this destruction was so bad that it was not reoccupied for quite some time, and then when it was reoccupied, it was only occupied by squatters. And in fact, these squatters were almost certainly Israelites. If you connect this destruction to the conquest, then you are left with nothing for Deborah and Barak to conquer. And as I said last week, it makes much more sense to assign the LB1 destruction around 1400 at Hazor to the Israelite conquest and assign this destruction to Deborah and Barak. And in fact, when you work out the date for the story of Deborah and Barak, you see that it happened at the end of the 13th century, and according to our chart here, around 1237 BC is when Hazor was destroyed. Now that date could be a little off one way or another, but it can't be too far wrong. Sometime around that date is when Deborah and Barak fought against the army of Jabin, king of Hazor. Now, in that story, it does not say specifically that the Israelites burned Hazor, but were led to that conclusion by the statements at the end of Judges chapter 4. The army was defeated out in the field in the Jezreel Valley, but then we're told after this great defeat, verses 23 and 24 of Judges 4, tells us, on that day God subdued Jabin, the Canaanite king, before the Israelites, the battle out in the field. And the hand of the Israelites grew stronger and stronger against Jabin, the Canaanite king, until they destroyed him. Now it appears from this that after they defeated his army out in the field, that they grew stronger and stronger against him, meaning against his capital, I would think, of Hazor, and eventually they destroyed him, and I would take that to mean they destroyed his capital city of Hazor. And if that's the correct interpretation, we have a very good correlation with the archaeological findings there, because, as I say, Hazor was severely destroyed toward the end of the 13th century B.C. So I think we can correlate this event there in Judges 4 with our archaeological findings. Then we have, now you have to realize that at this time, we're at the end of the reign of Ramses II, when he was not paying attention to affairs in Canaan. He was not campaigning, and I think there was a lot of revolts going on at this time, the Israelites among them, overthrowing Hazor, but there's evidence of other destructions right at this same time period. And I think that they can be related to the king of Shechem, because there are towns that are just at the edge of the territory occupied by Shechem. So maybe the Israelites are working again with the people of Shechem. We don't know. All we can do is kind of try to reconstruct things. But as soon as Merneptah came on the throne, now he was Ramses' son, Merneptah, He was the next king after Ramses II died. Ramses was a very old man. He was well into his 90s. And when Merneptah came on the throne, he was no spring chicken. He was probably in his 70s. But the very first thing he did was conduct a campaign into Canaan, and that's memorialized on the Israel stela. And on that stela, it mentions Israel. Merneptah brags about having defeated, in fact, annihilated Israel. So at this time, then, around 1210 BC, Israel was in the land, was known by the Egyptians by the name of Israel. This is very, very significant because we've talked about these theories about the emergence of Israel in the next century, in the 12th century, but here already, according to this extra-biblical document, never mind the Bible, we've got an extra-biblical document that places Israel in the land in 1210 BC. They're known by the name of Israel. And that's very, very significant. I believe that Israel came to the attention of the Egyptians through their conquest of Hazor. Now, Hazor was a great city-state, the largest, in fact, of all of the city-states in Canaan. Occupied over 50 acres, I think, is the figure for the area of Hazor. So it was a very important center, the most important in northern, the northern hill country area. And the Israelites overthrew it, according to Judges 4. And I think that and it was a time when the Israelite tribes came together to work together to overthrow Hazor. And I think this brought them to the attention of the Egyptians, brought them onto the international scene, so to speak. And so in Merneptah's stela, he brags about having overthrown Israel. Of course, Israel had to be somebody of importance, otherwise he would not brag about having defeated them. Let's take the rest of the time to look at the slides, and I'll talk about a little more about the Israel stela, as it's called, or the stela of Merneptah. And I'll also talk about Shiloh, because we have some evidence from the town of Shiloh that we can correlate with the book of Judges. And a little something from Site of Dan, if we have time.
Let's see. Is that bothering you?
Well, you can't see it too well, but there is the Merneptah stela. It's in the Egypt Museum, the Cairo Museum today. And it was discovered by Petrie when he excavated Merneptah's mortuary chapel. It's quite high. It's probably 7 feet high or so. He found it in 1895. And now it's in this museum in Cairo, and it's way off in a corner under a stairway. You'd never find it unless you knew it was there and were searching for it. But again, it's one of the most important things from Egypt as far as biblical studies are concerned because of the mention of Israel. Well, it's a eulogy to Merneptah. It's a hymn, really, written in poetic style, just extolling his virtues and his greatness as a pharaoh. Merneptah didn't rule all that long, but this was placed in his mortuary temple, telling of his great accomplishments. Most of it is taken up with his battles to the west against the Libyans. But right at the end, there's this little short section here, a little short poem concerning this campaign into Canaan. Now, just recently, an Egyptologist from the University of Chicago named Frank Yurko has correlated this poem here with some pictorial scenes at the Temple of Amun in Thebes. They were previously attributed to Ramses II, but Yurko has shown that the cartouches under those, there's some later cartouches, Seti I, I guess that's it. But underneath it are cartouches of Merneptah. And one of the places named here is Ashkelon. There's three cities shown there, and then another scene, which is not a city, but a battle in the open countryside. Of the three cities, only one name has survived, unfortunately, but that name is Ashkelon. And so he uses that to correlate with this particular campaign. And he believes the other two places are Gezer and Yenoam, but there's no way of proving it. It looks like his correlation is quite a good one. The one thing that's a little shaky is that this one scene of a battle out in kind of open countryside, he claims is depicting Israelites, and that the Egyptians are battling Israelites. That is a little shaky, because there's really nothing to go on. If the people depicted could be Canaanites as well as Israelites, but it shows a chariot, and I doubt very seriously if the Israelites had chariots at this time. But anyway, it's possible, I guess. The little poem here is written in chiastic style. You notice that it begins with these global statements. The princes are prostrate, saying, "Mercy, no, not one raises his head among the nine bows." That's the far reaches of the world. So it's a kind of a global statement about his predominance throughout the world. And it ends up the same way. All lands together, they're pacified. Everyone who's restless has been bound. And then the next ring deals with the large nation groups in the area. Desolation is for Tekeno, that's Libya. Hatti is pacified, that's the Hittites in Anatolia. And that's balanced off by Israel is laid waste, his seed is not. Haru, or Canaan, is become a widow for Egypt. So Israel is placed in the grouping of the major nation states between the Hittites to the north and the Libyans to the south, which is very interesting. Much has been made of the fact that the name Israel does not have a land determinative with it. All the names have a determinative that tell you if it's a city or a land or a people or what it is. Israel has the determinative for people, which would suggest that they are perhaps still nomadic. At least we know they do not have cities as these other peoples did. So Israel is placed with these larger nation groups. The name itself is masculine. So the scribe knew that Israel was a masculine figure. Nations usually are referred to in a feminine sense, as we do today, but Israel is referred to in the masculine. His seed is not. Of course, Manasseh boasts of having annihilated the Israelites, which of course he didn't do, but this is typical of these kinds of inscriptions. So Israel's laid waste, his seed is not, and as a result, Haru, or Canaan, is a widow for Egypt. And so from that, we can assume that Israel occupied all of Canaan and probably was the major power group in Canaan at this time, at the end of the 13th century B.C. Then the inner rings are references to specific city-states. Plundered is the Canaan. Now, many times this is a term for Gaza. Now, it might be referenced to the whole region of Canaan. I don't know. I think that's the way Bimson takes it. But it could also be a reference to Gaza. And then we have references to Ashkelon, Gezer, and Yenoam. These are specific cities that Merneptah claims to have conquered. Now, I spoke about the destructions that took place around this time. We have Hazor, but we have many others. And I think Manasseh is responding to unrest in Canaan, responding to these groups like the Israelites overthrowing Hazor, and perhaps others, perhaps the people of Shechem, expanding their holdings, destroying Egyptian fortresses and one thing and another. And so I think the first order of business for Manasseh when he took the throne was to come into Canaan and to reestablish Egyptian authority in the region. The important point is that at this time Israel is a significant entity in Canaan, Nephthah brags about having defeated them, so they could not just have emerged. They must have been in existence for a considerable length of time in order to have reached this status by the end of the 13th century. So this document alone really overthrows these theories about an emergence of Israel in the 12th century. Baloney. I mean, they were a nation to be reckoned with in the time of Merneptah, according to this extra biblical document. All right, let's quickly go to Shiloh here in the hill country. And of course, Shiloh was where the Israelites erected the tabernacle. And it became the first religious center of the Israelites from the time of the conquest in 1400 down to about 1085 B.C. when it was destroyed by the Philistines. So we have there over 300 years or so, where Shiloh was the religious center of the tribes of Israel. Here's the valley of Shiloh where the site is located. It's been excavated a couple of times over the decades. It was excavated by a Danish expedition back in the 20s and 30s. More recently, by the Israelis under Israel Finkelstein in the 1970s and 80s. Here are the excavation areas. Much of the site has been destroyed by later occupation during the Hellenistic Roman Byzantine period. But around the edges, we have some very important material. The black line here is a fortification wall around the site, and that dates back to the Middle Bronze period. Then after that, there was some late Bronze occupation, but from what has been found there, it appears that there were no structures as such, no buildings in the late Bronze period. Of course, that would be the very time when the Israelites were there. Over here in Area C, we have the remains of some structures from the Iron Age I, from the 12th century. And this material dates to the time of Eli and Samuel. Now that belongs to the next phase of our course, so we won't get into that. But what I want to talk about is the late Bronze material. Up in Area D here, they found a large pit full of late Bronze and pottery and other material. This is that Iron Age I structure that we can date to the time of Eli and Samuel. Here's some close-ups inside the ruins showing ash from the Philistine destruction. But we want to go up here to the north. Here's the Middle Bronze wall. And a lot of storage rooms were found inside the wall, abutting the wall, and in the ruins, a lot of jars. And amongst this material, evidence of cultic activity. This is all dating to the Middle Bronze period, a cult stand here, other items which indicate that there was some cultic activity here in the Middle Bronze period. And then we have this dump here from late Bronze, and then after that, a lot of pits from the Iron I period. But both late Bronze and Iron Wood would still be the time when the tabernacle was located there. This is the area where that debris was found. And in this late Bronze dump, they found a lot of evidence for cultic activity. That clay bowl, here's a gold butterfly. Okay, that's all I got from that. But Israel Finkelstein, the excavator, looked at this material and concluded that there was a cultic installation at Shiloh in the late Bronze I period, but no buildings related to this, at least none have been found today. Amongst this cultic material were a lot of animal bones, a lot of ash. Some of the bones were found still in bowls along with ash. It was quite clear that this was material from offerings, burnt offerings. They did a study on the bones found in this dump, and they determined that in the Middle Bronze period, there was a significantly high percentage of cattle bones, indicating that the people were urbanite people. sedentary people. In the Iron Age also, about the same percentage of cattle bones indicating urbanite population. But in the Late Bronze Period, a very low percentage of cattle bones, much larger percentage of sheep and goat, which is suggestive of a pastoral people. And so in the report, Finkelstein says, in the Late Bronze Age period, pastoral nomads came to Shiloh and had cultic activity. Pastoral lifestyle in the period of the Judges in the Late Bronze Age. So this evidence fits very nicely with the Bible. All right, Jericho, here's our middle building excavated by Garstang, and then just north of that, Kenyon, in her two squares, found just some fragments of walls, this bit of floor, and an oven here. This is a picture of Garstang's middle building here on the right. In her writings, Kenyon said that this is the only material she found that could be related to an Israelite conquest. Of course, it dates to the end of the 14th century BC. But here's this patch of floor, an oven, a juglet here, which you see here, and many articles and books. She says this is the only thing that might have any connection with the conquest, but there's no city wall, no city in fact, just that large building that Garstang found and these outbuildings. No, I think rather it is the Palace of Eglon that was found. Here's an example of some of the painted pottery found in the building, and then here's your Cypriot imported ware from the building and the vicinity of the building. Here's the little cuneiform tablet found just outside the building. Now here's Halpern's work and his reconstruction of the Palace of Eglon based on the terms used in Judges 3 and based on other parallel material from other sites. That's the plan. Then he's got this nice reconstruction. He explains the whole story of Ehud and Eglon from his reconstruction, with Ehud escaping through the toilet here and out through this door and making his way out. It's a very neat reconstruction. And if you compare his reconstruction with Garstang's middle building, you can see a very good correspondence there. So I think this building is indeed the Palace of Eglon. Now let's quickly go up to Hatzor, way up here in the north of the Sea of Galilee. Here's the citadel, or the upper city, the Acropolis of Hatzor. Hatzor was made up of an upper city and a lower city. And in the Late Bronze Period, both were occupied, the upper city and the lower city. But when the site was destroyed at the end of the 13th century, around 1230 or so BC, this lower city was never again occupied. That was the end of it. The Israelites came and occupied the upper city here. And in fact, Solomon fortified Hatzor, built a gate there, and built up the city walls and so on. All of these areas have been excavated that you see here, and wherever they excavated, they found a great thick layer of ash from that late 13th century destruction. And since the lower city was never reoccupied, it was simply left there, and we have all the evidence for that great destruction. A number of temples were found, and cultic shrines and so on. Here are some of the matzavot, the sacred stones that were found. A few statues were found. All these coming from the time of Deborah and Barak. Now we go quickly to Tel Dan. Now actually this has to do with the beginning of the Iron Age, but I want to bring it in here because it is significant for the Late Bronze Period. Now, whenever you mention a conquest early in the late Bronze Period, a conquest of around 1400 BC, the first question that always comes up is, where is the evidence for Israel in the late Bronze Age, in the late Bronze II period, the period we're talking about today? Well, the Israelites were archaeologically invisible. They had no material culture when they came into the land. They had been wandering around in the desert. They didn't know how to build buildings. They didn't know how to make pottery. They didn't know how to make metal. They didn't really know anything about these crafts and so on. And so it would have taken them some time to learn these skills. So they merely adopted the Canaanite culture and learned these skills from the Canaanites. And they were pastoralists during the period of the Judges. They lived in tents. We read that over and over and over in the book of Judges. So we cannot dig up an Israelite building or an Israelite city in the late Bronze II period because they didn't build them. We have to come at it sort of indirectly, and as I have hopefully demonstrated, we do have evidence that the events recorded there for this period really happened. We have Eglon's palace. We have a destruction of Hazor. And now we go to Dan. And here we have some additional evidence. We read in, what is it, chapter 17, anyway, at the end of the book of Judges, we read the story of the migration of the tribe of Dan up to the city of Laish, which they conquered and burned, and then they occupied and renamed it Dan. We can bracket when this took place. In the Deborah and Barak story, it talks about Dan, why did you stay by the ships? You look at the tribal allotment of Dan, it's a little narrow strip that comes from just west of Jerusalem all the way over to the coast. And so it seems at the time of Deborah and Barak, Dan was still in its tribal allotment, still occupying the area all the way up to the coast. Then, if we go through the story in Judges about the migration, it says that the Danites had a shrine all the time that the tabernacle was at Shiloh. Well, that tabernacle was destroyed, or at least moved, and Shiloh was destroyed in about 1085. So the Danites must have taken the site before 1085. So between 1230 and 1085 is when the migration took place. And in fact, we can pinpoint it a little more accurately. The most likely time for this migration to have taken place is when the Philistines came in and occupied the coastal area. And this took place in the 8th year of Ramses III, according to his inscriptions, which in terms of absolute date would be 1177 BC. And on your handout of the archaeological ages, this is the time I use as the cutoff at the end of late Bronze and the beginning of the Iron Ages when the Philistines invade the land. So this would be the most logical time because they came in and occupied the coastal area. It would have displaced the Danites who were living there. On the other hand, when you read the stories of Samson, they are still living in the cities further inland, in the Shephelah. So it seems to be only the people who lived right on the coast that migrated northward to Dan, and that seems to have taken place sometime around 1175 BC. Here at the site of Dan, the excavator Abraham Baran has found evidence for the first occupation by the Danites. It's an area here, Area B, just behind the Israelite gate. And here he has a very nice series of blue is the late bronze material. Then there's this very thick destruction layer. The city was burned, and this took place early in the 12th century. He says first half of the 12th century and doesn't date it any closer than that. And then that is followed by the what is shown in brown here, a period of squatter occupation where the inhabitants dug pits. They didn't build any buildings, they just dug pits and they more or less squatted. And these new inhabitants brought with them collar-brimmed store jars. And these store jars are not native to this area. They're native to the Central Hill Country, and in fact have been associated with the Israelites in the 12th century B.C. The jars have been tested using neutron activation analysis, and it has been determined that they were made of clay, not native to Dan, but native to areas further south. So the excavator, Abraham Barant, wrote a nice little article a few years back where he says, this is the evidence for the Danites coming to the Canaanite city of Laish and burning it with fire. We're told in that account they burned it with fire. Here's the plan view. The blue shows here a tomb from the late Bronze period, a couple of walls here. Here are some of those pits from the squatter occupation in the early 12th century. And then this is followed later on in the Iron Age with some structures on top of the squatter occupation. So this fits very nicely with our biblical evidence. Now this tomb is very interesting. There is a lot of imported pottery in that tomb, Mycenaean ware, as you see here. It's called the Mycenaean grave, I guess. And a beautiful, what's called a charioteer vase, well known in Greece, but this is the only one found so far in Israel. Now that's very interesting because in that account, there in Judges, there are several references to the men of Sidon. Of course, Sidon is a coastal town. And Laish would be a good place to take because they were far away from Sidon. It would lead you to believe that this city had some connection with Sidon. Maybe they were a colony or an inland post or something for the merchants, for the traders from Sidon. Of course, they would be on the coast and get all the maritime trade, and possibly they worked with the people here at Dan to bring this material inland. This tomb is the richest tomb we have of imported pottery, and indeed shows these people had connections with the coast, and we have the connection actually referred to there in Judges. Now here we have the squatter pottery. No, I'm sorry, this is the local pottery from the destruction layer, and all of this is very, very early in the 12th century, sometime around 1180, 1190 B.C. And then this is followed by the squatter phase here, a lot of pits, as you see here, and then this Israelite type of pottery, collared rim store jars, so-called because of this little ring here around the neck, referred to as a collar. And it's very typical of the Iron Age I period and of Israelite occupation. And so that material would also date to the first half of the 12th century B.C. Now, what does that have to do with the late Bronze Age? Again, we can verify a story in the Bible which talks about a tribe or part of a tribe that migrated. Now, those who would say that the Israelites just came into being in the 12th century would have a hard time with this archaeological evidence because it's early, say 1175, early in the 12th century, and if we relate it to that story in the Bible, that indicates that this tribe had a prior history. They didn't just come into being in the 12th century. They had a prior history. They came from somewhere else. They immigrated to this place of Dan. So I think, again, this gives us evidence to support the biblical account of things that the Israelite tribes were already there in the late Bronze period, late Bronze II. And here we have archaeological evidence for the migration of a part of the tribe as recorded in the Judges. So we have to put all this together to try to bring together all the evidence we have to support the fact that the Israelites did not just come into being in the 12th century, but they were there long before that, in fact, in the late Bronze Age. Probably arrived, came into being, if you want to use that term, sometime around 40. Okay, well, our time is up, so next week the exam.